This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The solutions are here to solve climate change. We just have to implement them. And what's holding us back, that friction, is what we believe is possible and what we believe will work.
Do you ever look around and think that if our agricultural and transportation systems could get a little more efficient, we might just be able to slow down the rate of climate change? Well, our guest today has spent a lot of time thinking about that and what people are calling tactical urbanism. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Gregory Schwartz, whose new book is Bright Green Future: How Everyday Heroes Are Reimagining the Way We Feed, Power, and Build Our World. Taped before the pandemic, our conversation highlights urban planning efforts in Dallas, nonprofits in Detroit, as well as other movements and innovations that are providing hope in the struggle against climate change. Schwartz also alerts us to a set of newfangled made-up policy words like strodes and blots that may be coming soon to a neighborhood near you. I'm joined now by Gregory Schwartz. His new book, which he co-authored with Trevor Cohen, is entitled Bright Green Future: How Everyday Heroes Are Reimagining the Way We Feed, Power, and Build Our World. Greg, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here, Alex.
So first off, there are lots of environmental books out there. How are you and Trevor trying to add to the conversation?
Basically, what we wanted to do was make these ideas mainstream and approachable and accessible, because I've written academic pieces before and we wanted to bring this to the mainstream. And so we wanted to really dispel some of the myths about climate change and how to fix it.
So I wanted to talk to you about something that is called tactical urbanism. How would you define that?
So tactical urbanism, or lean urbanism, incremental urbanism, are these ways to get around city codes and city councils and make changes quickly to the infrastructure of, say, your local main street or your street. Basically, our cities have changed and become very zoned, and so there are these separated uses, and they've become very, of course, car-dominated. And so what that makes is a less inviting, less human-scaled experience. And so when we want to convert those back, basically the big push is called new urbanism. We're trying to push back to multi-use spaces and more human-scaled spaces. And so tactical urbanism helps us to get there more quickly, rather than waiting 10 years for these policy changes or legal changes to be able to shift how we shape our streets and cities. And so what it is let's just say in a weekend, you are trying to make buildings and streets have a more intimate interaction and more intimate interface. Really simple changes like bringing in planters, bringing in cafe seating, painting a bike lane in, painting in crosswalks, things like that that happen immediately. And you just basically risk the fact that you might get caught for this and get fined or this and that. And very often cities find that it works so well to bring in foot traffic, to increase business in the area, that they change their laws and make them more easy to legally do these things. It's about short-term incremental change that can eventually become solid and real and long-lasting. So bringing in food trucks to vacant lots, bringing in booths where you actually put them in a parking spot and pay the parking meter and have that booth there all day. So you're transforming this space and making it more human scale, more active, more local, bringing in business and making it a more pleasant experience, not just this highway where, you know, human beings can't walk, can't interact. And you can do that in a weekend rather than in 5 years or 10 years without changing any solid infrastructure.
Here in the Bay Area, where we live, we can pretty much assume that most city planners and people who are approving of these zoning the bureaucrats that you need to get through to get your bike lanes and your planters approved, they're just as environmentally conscious as you might be, and they are probably just as progressive politically. But it's an interesting dichotomy when these bureaucrats are kind of put to the test to try to follow the rules, but also do what might be better for a community or the planet.
Yeah, and the machinery just can move slowly, and that's the problem. Just this approval process and having a vote, having a bill passed, it could be a local measure, it could be a state level, and these things just take a while, and so it can get discouraging. A huge theme in our book is putting the power back in the individual's hands and then the community scale and making that effectual and quick. In a progressive area, it's already easier. And a lot of the tactical urbanism that we see, it's in so many cities already. So it's in various political environments. You know, they might be more conservative, might progressive, but it's just a way to locally decide what you want.
Let's talk about some of the less homogenous political communities, like Dallas, Texas. That's one that you outline in your book.
Mm-hmm.
How are you seeing examples of tactical urbanism there?
There's a guy there named Jason Roberts in Dallas who started an organization called Better Block, and it just helps communities to basically revitalize what we call Main Street, you know, their local Main Street. It's personalizing this space between buildings and streets. And so he has made a lot of changes to his local area. And he's also changing a two-lane street into a one-way street, putting in planters, putting in bike lanes. And he based a lot of what he did on the work of Jeanette Sadiq Khan, who's the transit commissioner of New York City. She, on this one weekend, wanted to show what Times Square would be like if it were a city plaza. And so she borrowed from the city parks department these large planters and potted plants and put just lawn chairs out there and kind of sort of cordoned it off and let people feel what it would be like. And it totally transformed that space in sort of a guerrilla way. And he really took to that, and he's done a lot of that in Dallas.
Makes Times Square sound almost appetizing there.
Right. And Times Square's gone through a lot of phase changes. I mean, 20 years ago, it was a little bit seedy, and now it's much more sort of Disneyfied and family-friendly. But just as far as, how you use that space, it's an experiment. There's also this idea of linear parks, which is really cool. When you have old highways that are unused, old railway lines that are unused, they're, of course, linear in shape, and a lot of cities are transforming them into only bike and walking transit corridors. And you can imagine the property values next to them are going up, and it used to be a dead space, and now it's an active space. A buddy of mine is always on the one in Chicago. It's called 606 Park. Dallas, it's called Clyde Warren Park. DC has the 11th Street Bridge, the Beltline in Atlanta. So these are really popular, and that would definitely be in the sort of category of tactical urbanism as well, but now they've become actual policy.
You also talk about Akron, Ohio. What's unique about Akron that made you kind of want to focus on their efforts in terms of tactical urbanism?
Yeah, we have several examples. And Akron, you know, they get a little bit, it's a community revival there.
And this is a traditional, it's a rubber town, right? Goodyear, it has a long history of industry and manufacturing. And it's obviously had to transform as the American economy is kind of transforming out of its manufacturing era.
Absolutely. So, you know, it's Rust Belt, and you see a lot of spaces that have sort of transformed into unused spaces or less vital spaces for people to just inhabit. And so there's a lot of focus on bringing in musical artists, bringing in food trucks, bringing in festivals, and getting it just livened up. It lets locals make money. It brings back a feeling of community. You know, that's been the main shift in that area. And then that translates into new businesses opening, and you start to see a more of a mixed-use space just by practice, not even by, you know, the codes. But Akron has transformed so much. And then, of course, again, this is the short-term efforts to get towards what we call new urbanism. And I spoke to the PR person for the Congress of the New Urbanism, that's their title, and they're sort of over all of this, and they're constantly trying to make work and home closer by creating mixed-use spaces and shorter commutes and changing what one person we interviewed called a strode, which is a combination between a street and a road, into more of a, again, a human space, mixed-use, walkable, and human scale.
What's the difference between a street and a road anyway?
So his point, Chuck Marone, is that...
Grammatically, I don't really know the difference.
Yeah, well, in his, those are broad terms, but he says a street is one that's made for building businesses and human interaction and sort of local, what you would like to walk down, and coffee shops and interaction and dog parks, but a road is just a thoroughfare. And so he's saying that we try to do both, and it doesn't do well. You have like two lanes going either direction with a middle lane for turning, and it's just, it's all designed for the car, and they're trying to put in businesses, but it, nobody wants to walk there. And so we have so many of those, these long commercial strips that are in suburbs, and everyone's just, you know, flying through there at 50 miles an hour.
Sure.
And they're trying to still have business. So the neighborhood we're in right now, for instance, is a street. Cars move slow. It's designed for people to walk and to bike and to walk dogs. And so he's saying we should do one or the other, you know, put people on a highway to get somewhere and then have a small town experience where you can really live, build wealth for those local businesses, walk into shops. But yeah, it's a funny term, strode.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Greg Schwartz. His new book, which he co-authored with Trevor Cohen, is entitled Bright Green Future: How Everyday Heroes Are Reimagining the Way We Feed, Power, and Build Our World. So, Greg, can we talk about the blending of the rural and urban lines? I'm thinking of Detroit, which you cover in your book, and Earthworks Detroit, where there's this blurred line between rural and urban. You refer to it as urban prairie. I've only been to Detroit's airport. I don't know the region very well. Maybe you can kind of explain what Earthworks Detroit does and the problem they're trying to solve.
Yeah, it's an amazing example of taking a crisis and seeing the opportunity in it. And that could be the title of our book, Taking a Crisis and Seeing the Opportunity. I spoke with Patrick Crouch, who heads Earthworks, and they basically are a 2.5-acre urban organic farm in Detroit, and they supply food for the Capuchin Soup Kitchen. So they give this food away for free, a large part of it. And what happened in Detroit, as we all know, is the economy sort of imploded when GM and other auto manufacturers basically declined, and there was an exodus, and unemployment is just skyrocketed. And you have a lot of urban blight, and you have abandoned lots. And so the city itself is 139 square miles. It's very expansive, and 40 of those square miles have been abandoned. And so you're actually seeing a return to wilderness. There are wild boars and flocks of birds and bushes and trees and foliage, and it's amazing. And so you have unemployment, and you have neighborhoods that were already food deserts. And so they took that as an opportunity, and now there are about 1,000 urban, mostly organic gardens in those spaces that supply 15% of the food supply. And so that's local, so it's cutting down on the carbon footprint. They're organic, so it's going against sort of this conventional pesticide-based. And it also solves it works to solve what we call food insecurity. And so just people having access to healthy food. They have of volunteers. They have community plots where people have plots on the farm. They have a community orchard. They have 12 interns. They grow transplant seedlings for other local organic gardens. And it's what's called blotting, because it's usually these farms are smaller than a block, an urban block, but they're larger than a house plot. So it's called blotting. And they turn
these...
Is this
like a strode?
It's like a strode, yeah. When you're an academic person, you get to make up your own words. An academic or a rapper, you make up your own words. And I am the former. But so actually 20 of these blots pushed together is what the earthworks is. And so that's about 2.5 acres, which is about... two football fields, two U.S. football fields. And so that doesn't sound maybe huge, but it's astonishing the thousands of pounds of food you can crank out every year. They also have beehives because they want to be able to pollinate their own food and also provide honey. And they have a massive composting program. And the problem with composting usually is that the farms are, you know, you might get your corn from Iowa, but you live in Berkeley, California, and so you know, it. How do you refertilize that farm? So there's all this dislocation of soil fertility. So if you grow everything in Nebraska and you ship it all, well, really more in reality, California is the leading agricultural state. So let's say we ship all our food to all these other states, we're exporting our soil fertility and actually our water.
And using fossil fuels to move all that generally. Shipping lettuce from the Central Valley of California to Nebraska mm-hmm. for consumption is about as irrational as and as carbon intensive as humanly possible. We're basically moving fibrous water around using oil.
Yeah, I mean, oh my goodness, if we even get into the largest use of water in the state of California, and we have a massive drought problem, is to grow food that's not for human consumption. It's alfalfa and prairie for cows. And that's one quarter of all water used for any purposes in California. And then we export some of that. It's just, yeah, so you're talking about the movement of food. Yeah, so when you have locally grown food and then locally replenished compost, you know, it just goes down the street and then you re-fertilize, you're keeping that soil fertility local. And in what they call, you know, late capitalism, which is where all the production and consumption and labor and supplies are all separate geographically, that's massive carbon footprint, as you said, and you start to lose track of where all the water and where all the soil fertility and where it's all going. And so certain places can get very depleted. And so this is a very big, important and positive move, urban gardening. And the in Earthworks is also about, you know, Patrick Crouch, who runs it, he ran a farm in Maryland, which was basically in a wealthy white area. And he said, you know, I want social justice to be a part of this. And I know we're going to talk about another farm that's really into that in a minute, but he likes Earthworks because it's in a largely minority area, I think largely black, but mixed, quite mixed. And he wanted, that's important to him because food deserts are often in those areas. I've done some mapping projects about that. It's pretty striking when you look at the racial component of urban deserts, food deserts. And so that's important to him. And as I said, they have 12 interns. And so education is important. And just changing the narrative, changing the knowledge, changing this idea of separating us from our food production. I mean, most of us, you know, 2% of us are farmers. 100 years ago, half of us were farmers in this country. And so we're just returning to that knowledge. Both of my parents were Nebraska farmers, and you never talk to anyone in the U. I mean, I'm 47, but young people that their parents are farmers, that just doesn't happen. So now that is, you know, I have my students in class. I say, raise your hand if you grow any food at home. And I'll get about 10% of them say, yeah, we grow tomatoes, we grow this, we grow that. It's starting to come around. And you're not going to go usually buy pesticides and buy chemical fertilizers. So mostly that's organic. So that's a big, big deal. And the crazy thing is the largest crop in the U.S. is urban lawns and suburban lawns. That's our biggest crop spatially.
We have enough lawns being grown to cover the entire state of Georgia, I've read.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So that's more than corn, which blows my mind. But and so if we just convert a quarter of that, half of that, to crops.
And it's all about lawn shaming. Ultimately, we need to change the dream. The dream used to be a lawn and a white picket fence and a car and two cars and three kids. And we're changing those goals as a society, slowly but surely.
Yeah, it's an anachronistic cultural symbol. It's from England, and back in the day, it meant when you have a lawn, it's like you have your feudal estate, and you have your crops, and you have your housing, and you have a wall around your estate. And then if you have extra land, you put a lawn on it to say, hey, look, I have extra land. I'm wealthy. I don't even need to grow crops. So it was a symbol of wealth. And then in the East Coast, that worked, and in England, that worked because they have a lot of rain. And on the West Coast, we don't have the rain. And we forgot long ago what that really means to have a lawn. And so it's kind of absurd to continue that tradition. And so lawn shaming, I encourage lawn shaming. No, I shouldn't say that.
No, it's okay. It's one of the forms of shaming and bullying that, not overt bullying, right. but I think in the media, you know, in terms of images of opulence, it'd be nice to see some pretty cool desert front yards in some of these movies and things like that instead of it is deep rooted, no pun intended.
And again, in California, just with our water, we use the same amount of water. I dug into this quite a bit in my research. We use the same amount of water to water golf courses every day in California as for the entire state, everyone in the state to bathe. So that's a lot of water going to grass, which is non-essential for survival.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Gregory Schwartz, whose new book is entitled Bright Green Future.
So you mentioned in passing another organization that their real focus is on their employees, it seems like. That's why you decided to cover them, Planting Justice. They hire minorities and formerly incarcerated people to do their work. Why don't you explain what sets them apart from your average urban farming organization?
Yeah. You know, I spoke with Hale Zandi, and I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. Usually I'm good at that with my students. She's an intellectual, really, I would say, and she's incredibly passionate about social justice, about land issues, about decolonizing our food supply, and that's kind of a catchphrase, decolonizing a lot of aspects of society. And, you know, basically we have this mainstream, often unhealthy food, like processed food, chemical intensive farming. And that's been superimposed upon the traditional cultures that were here that grew, you know, healthy, natural food. And that's in most of the world, really. And she talks about decolonizing that. What their focus is transforming food deserts into places with healthy organic food. They take formerly incarcerated people hire them to train others to build, and also to build organic raised food beds and organic gardens. For instance, at Oakland High Schools, they also have an organic farming program at San Quentin, which I think is amazing. They have this garden, just like we do at Laney College. I oversee the community garden that we have at Laney College, and it's somewhat similar, and we provide herbs for the culinary department there, and they train inmates there, and then when they have some formerly incarcerated come out and they hire them. And one example was a man who, Anthony Forrest, who worked with, has worked with them for 6 years, and he's kind of their poster guy for success. And he trains students at Oakland's schools on how to build these gardens. He builds them himself. And so they're kind of trying to solve the economic crisis. She said, you know, the economic crisis, the health crisis, and the climate crisis kind of all overlap, and they're trying to affect them all at once, and you kind of can't help but affect them all at once. She also has a real focus on land specifically, and the idea that, you know, we're on, in the East Bay, we're on Ohlone land, O-H-L-O-N-E, the Ohlone tribe, and so they have part of their land that they own in Planting Justice, they're giving back to the Ohlone tribe in what's called the Sogorayate, hope I'm pronouncing that right, Sogorayate Land Trust. And so she's a very, Hale is a very passionate climate justice, social justice activist, really. And she used to study feminist movements in the Middle East. And it was interesting because she said her dad's from Iran, her mom's from Europe. And when we were in the war in the Middle East, the U.S., she said half of her family was dropping bombs on the other half, and it started to relate to what was going on at home. We were there for fossil fuels. Anyway, she's an activist at heart, which makes me like her.
So after having read your book, Greg, what do you want readers to have taken away from it?
I mean, really, with this book, we want to dispel, as I say, myths. And the solutions are here to solve climate change. We just have to implement them. And what's holding us back, that friction, is what we believe is possible and what we believe will work. And so, for instance, there's a belief that helping the planet hurts business. But that is just proving less and less and less true. And you know, so helping the planet actually helps businesses. It helps keep alive those resources that you need to profit from. Also, keeping your body healthy keeps the planet healthy. Keeping the planet healthy keeps your body healthy. So business and the planet, and business and the planet and your body, all are mutually enhancing. And so they're not contradictory concepts. And so the solutions are here. They help each other, and we just have to get over some of these small hurdles in beliefs and just implement them. And we are in a real crisis, but it can be turned around relatively quickly if we just take action. It's not gloom and doom. We can be better than we ever were, and I truly believe that.
So folks can learn more about the book at theplanetdoctor.com. Greg's new book is entitled Bright Green Future. Greg, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You bet. Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The New Master Sounds, Taj Mahal, and Chet Atkins. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.